due to the.
So you were able to climb it, huh?
Yeah, I was. The production company paid a lot of money for us to have full access to the entire base. And back in the day, that nuclear weapons storage area, which, by the way, also housed a rather innocuous but chilling little building at the far end of the nuclear bunkers, where they kept the biotoxin weapons. We had some very horrible biological weapons in England on that base at the time, including most likely anthrax, plague, and God knows what else. And the rationale at that point in the Cold War, as it always was, well, the Russians have them, we got to have them too. But yes, I did climb that tower, and the view is something. Back in the day, though, that was all a shoot-to-kill area. It's surrounded by three separate compartments of barbed wire. One of them would have had dogs in it, another one guards, another one just sort of an open area. And if you were in the wrong place at the right time, you would be shot first and questions would be asked after the fact. This was one of the most highly secured areas in our entire NATO establishment. And at the time, my best understanding remains that we had more nuclear weapons there than we had at any other one place in our NATO facilities, and that it was in complete violation of our treaty with the United Kingdom at the time. So the backstory there is not very pleasant. But on that first night, these unknowns came in over this weapons storage area. For some reason, they were either not fired on, or if they were, there was no results. I don't know what that story was. But because there was so much moisture in the air, you could see those beams of light coming from those, let's call them machines, right down to the ground, like lines drawn, you know, with light. Also that first night, law enforcement personnel at the nearby east gate of the sister base, RAF Woodbridge, observed a small light go down in the woods, and that was Airman John Burroughs. And John very rightly radioed in that report and asked for permission to investigate. Again, it did not seem to be a crash. Airman Burroughs radioed in to Central Security Command, I guess, and asked for permission to investigate. He was joined by Jim Peniston, and they were driven in by another personnel as far as they could get into the woods. Then they continued on foot. And I must keep this general here because they're the experiencers on this, and they're going to be the ones to put this into our hands next month when their book comes out. But by all accounts, they encountered a machine of undetermined origin. Not terribly large, 7 feet perhaps, triangular, tapering upward, the appearance of a black, glassy kind of surface, and it was moving slowly through the woods at about chest height. And depending on the account that, you know, there are a number of accounts that are credited to them, but there is aspects of missing time here. John is actually not sure, and I heard him say this in England in 2010, he is not sure whether or not he drew his weapon on it or whether or not he impulsively jumped on it and it went maybe 10 meters with him holding on, or whether or not he was abducted that night. He doesn't know. And Jim's memory is riddled with a certain amount of unanswered questions as well. Where these things came down in the woods, they tore out part of forest canopy. If they touched a tree, bark was removed. There were impressions in the soil. In the case of the landing site that Colonel Halt and his men encountered on the third night, they left this, at least one of them left a triangular series of circular impressions, equilateral triangle, in the soil, and each one of those impressions had an elevated background count of beta and gamma radiation readings, on the third night, and again, this is a very compact version. On the third night, Colonel Halt and a contingent of men went out to investigate other sighting reports. And one of these things came in over their head. They all observed it. You can hear them reacting to it in the audio tape that Colonel Halt recorded that night on his microcassette recorder, which he had with him. And you can hear the tension in their voices, and it shined a beam of light right down to where they were. Meanwhile, in a slightly removed part of the area, in a farmer's field called Capel Green, Larry Warren, my co-author, who was an Air Force security specialist, an Air Force security police officer, and another contingent of men had been ordered into the woods to surround a very anomalous thing. It was a self-illuminated ground fog, and they did that, and they observed a small reddish light coming in from the direction of the North Sea, which is only about 5 or 6 miles from that location. And that light came in over that field and over that ground fog, and then literally exploded with magnesium brightness, so much so that it burned the retinas of my co-author's eyes. And that is not some wild claim. We have the Air Force medical paperwork to back that up. And when they could see again, because it was sort of a flash that left everybody unable to refocus for a few seconds, there was now a machine of undetermined origin sitting in that ground fog. The situation continued into the night. Ultimately, three presences, three beings appeared right next to the craft, were observed by those in there. A base ranking officer who we are convinced and maintain was the wing commander, Gordon Williams, came into the area and essentially had a peaceful standoff with these three presences. Ultimately, the men were brought back to the base, told to not talk about this, and one would think that was it. And the fact was, it was only getting started in a way. The next night, Larry and a number of the other men who were firsthand witnesses were taken against their will, some of them chemically subdued, and put through something that I call Disneyland on LSD. They either were in a secured facility beneath the base, or that was the impression that they were given through whatever mind-altering was done with them. I think that this was done in part to show, put the fear of God in them, for one thing, so that they wouldn't ever talk about this. But if they did, that the implanted memories and the real memories would kind of weave themselves together, and they would sound, mentally unstable, and that there'd be a better chance of their testimony or their accounts being discounted by anybody that, was aware of them. Larry left the service, the United States Air Force, 6 months later with a fully honorable discharge, returned to civilian life, but was already in the throes of post-traumatic stress, was not adjusting well, and was obsessed with what had happened to him and those men in the woods that night. And he was not one of the first. He was the first person to come forward and has stood by his story for over 30 years. I think he is a true American hero, and without him, ultimately, we may well have learned about this event, but we may not have. And I think that...
Yeah, but that makes you wonder how many other events have happened that we haven't heard about,
Well, that's right. Larry is what you'd call a whistleblower, and a lot of people are familiar with that term in sort of a pop culture sense, but it is a real psychological designation, and whistleblowers are different than the great majority of us. In some cases, it may be because they were raised with a profound sense of morality or right or wrong, and conditioned to think that when something was wrong or somebody was having something wrong done to them, you intercede, even at the risk of your own safety and peace of mind. And that is just what he did. And he basically hung in the wind for quite a number of years before anyone came forward to back him up. And I have spoken with some of the men who shared this experience with him. And even all these years later, their attitude is, does anybody think for a minute that the world is going to change if I come forward, and everybody's going to think then that, you know, okay, it's all good, and, you know, Larry was right? Or are they just going to start attacking me and questioning my motives? And years ago, I would have encouraged everybody in that circle that night that was with Larry to come forward, and I hope others ultimately will. Like many of the Roswell witnesses came forward years, if not decades later. At the same time, know what you're getting into. If you put yourself in the public arena and maintain that something extraordinary has happened to you, there are people waiting to take you down. And if they can't crack the credibility of your story or your evidence, they will attack your character. It's not a pretty situation.
No, it certainly isn't. And that's how they have successfully kept whistleblowers at arm's length, I guess, from the mainstream media and other people who, you know, want to check reliable sources, et cetera. Correct. And usually when you're a whistleblower, you don't have much to back you up except what you saw.
That's correct. In Larry's case, it's ironic, but what stands as the best set of physical evidence for any of the events in question that constitute the Rendlesham Forest incident lies with Larry and the exact precise location where his event took place. And I recently sent you a column I wrote for Gary Hazeltine's terrific magazine that comes out of the UK, which I would encourage any of your listeners to subscribe to.
Yeah, it's called UFO Truth, right?
That is it, UFO Truth Magazine. And a couple of issues ago, I wrote a piece which lays out every bit of the physical evidence, the laboratory reports to back it up, the voice stress analysis of the original audio tapes that we had recorded, et cetera, et cetera. It is a damning picture, and it is also backed up by documentation, other accounts, et cetera. But there is no question that there were profound changes to the soil on the exact, not nearly exact, but the exact site of where Larry's encounter took place in that field in Suffolk, England.
Now, when we talk about all of this, so that this happened, what year, 60?
It happened 1980, December 1980.
80, okay, 80. Yeah. I got my 8 and my 6 twisted here. Anyway, in 1980, we were just now beginning to understand about things about mind control, like MK Ultra and things like that.
Yes.
So that prompts me to ask the question about what these people saw after the brilliant flash of light and all of that. Do you think that was from our government or from the extraterrestrials? That's what I'm going to refer to them as, time travelers, whatever.
Yeah. I think in this case, and I have to say, I spent quite a number of years questioning this and coming at it from every angle possible. Again, our book took a full 9 years to write, and in that time we returned to the United Kingdom repeatedly at our own expense to continue to gain access to other witnesses, develop evidence, revisit the locations, do interviews, etc. I'm convinced that this part of the event was genuinely part of the whole anomalous thing. And for anyone who feels, and it's a very good question, was this whole thing the result of some extremely brilliantly engineered mind control experiment involving these Air Force personnel, or was it the result of a genuine other intelligence incursion of some sort? I would go with the latter. No matter what, the greatest mind control experiment in the world does not melt sand and turn it into glass, which is what that happened at that site. It does not cause seeds grown in the affected soil compared to random control samples taken out in the field to only grow mutant strains of themselves and take much longer to grow than all of the control sample tests did. It did not cause the tiny metallic particles naturally occurring in the soil in that area to be in a concentration of more than four times the amount in the surrounding area in the field, and a number of other things. These kind of truly dramatic physiological changes are not the result of mind control. This is the real deal.
Now, the reason I brought this up, one of the common threads at Rendlesham and at Roswell, as far as I'm concerned, is there seems to be some nuclear activity going on at time. You know.
Yes.
It makes me wonder, and I've wondered aloud on the air and a few other places, and you and I have talked about it.
Yes.
What is it about the nuclear bombs that have attracted these events? And obviously they have, or at least I think they have.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. And it's not just our nuclear ordnance, it's nuclear facilities, nuclear power stations. Almost anything nuclear seems to be of interest to them, in quotes. Now, this was first referred to officially in a very important document that you are aware of, and that is Project Sign, which was the first full-scale report on this UFO, or as it was called back then, flying saucer phenomena. And the report, an Air Force report, was published in February 1948. And in that report, I wish I had it at hand, because it's an amazing statement, and it reads like an old film script rather than a government document. But what they are saying flat out is, in light of humanity's behavior for the past millenniums and the fact that we do have nuclear weapons now, they should, above all else, be interested in our behavior and our growing technology, because 100 years from now or so, we may be out in space with our incredibly destructive weapons and our extremely rage-filled, aggressive psychology. So you also know that besides Roswell, which was at the time the only nuclear strike force in the world, Bentwaters had the largest backline deployment of nuclear ordnance in NATO at the time. And we now know through other courageous individuals who have come forward, like Robert Salas, who was involved in the Malmstrom Air Force Base nuclear missile UFO shutdown at the time in 1967. And now we have an entire book on the subject by Robert Hastings called UFO and Nukes, which does nothing but document cases of UFO incursions over nuclear bases. There is cause for, I think, any intelligence to be concerned about humanity's relationship with nuclear energy.
And when we talk about this particular incident, I mean, you've lived with this for years now, Peter.
Yeah.
Have you reached any kind of definitive opinion, or you still just got a lot of open questions?
The
opinion I'm asking about is, who were they, where'd they come from, and did the Air Force already know about it?
Well, as far as definitive opinions regarding the intelligences behind what we call the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident of 1980, no. And I've only been studying it for 26 years or so. I do not know. And there's no reason that I should. I don't channel aliens. I don't have deep contacts in the Department of Defense. I don't have, a source within the National Security Agency. I'm an independent investigative writer doing the best they can with the information they're able to unearth, and doing my best to keep my reputation as straightforward as it can be so that I can continue to gain the confidences of individuals who have been involved or who do have pieces of the puzzle. But I think it would be arrogant for me to say or even suggest that I know what that intelligence or those intelligences were. I do not know. I am convinced, however, they were anomalous, non-standard, and not human.
And when we talk about the things you do know about this, Peter, mm-hmm. after all these years of investigation, mm-hmm. The thing that I don't think I've ever asked you about before, and as long as we've known each other, it may be amazing to me now that I think about it, mm-hmm. but I have never asked you really if you saw any evidence that the Air Force was expecting this to happen there.
Well, that's a great question, Jerry. And in the course of my initial investigation with all of the interviews that I had done with Larry in the first year or so of our relationship working on the book, and in all of the supporting information I was able to pull up, I did find information that to me was very unnerving and did suggest, at the least, that maybe the United States Air Force did have some idea of what they were sending, certainly the men on the third night that were with Larry, into. But you know what? I rejected it initially because it was so troubling to me, and I didn't want to think that such a thing was possible. But in retrospect, yes, I do feel that may have been the case. Again, the Air Force on that third night took people like Larry off of their guard posts, Larry's being at the furthest end of the main runway at RAF Bentwaters by perimeter post 18, brought them out to this area, or at least, say, within half a mile of, you know, this anomalous self-illuminated fog, broke them into three-man teams, disarmed them. Each three-man team had one radio. They were sent into the woods to quote-unquote investigate a disturbance.
You mean they took their weapons away from them?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And the fact is, they should have never had those weapons when they left the base. It's all right, of course, for any a member of the American military to carry a weapon, a loaded weapon, on their military installation, but not in the surrounding countryside. And in fact, when these men were taken off the base, certainly most of them were fully armed. It wasn't until they got to the area where the vehicles stopped on the logging road that led down to Capel Green that a armorer's vehicle, which is really not much more than a pickup truck with metal racks on the back, that their M16s and what other weapons were collected. So when they were sent out to investigate that disturbance, they were unarmed. In retrospect, I think that was a very important decision. Had they been armed when this thing appeared, you know, just think back to what happened, and I'm using a science fiction model here, but sometimes those are the only things we have to refer to, that extraordinary moment in the classic science fiction classic, The Day the Earth Stood Still, when, you know, the UFO lands across the street from the White House and Michael Rennie, playing the particularly civilized alien, gets out of the craft and is shot by personnel with weapons because they're frightened and, you know, somebody's a little trigger happy. No, they were disarmed. They were sent into this area. And when they came upon this phenomena, I mean, again, a self-illuminated ground fog about a foot off the ground, I forget, maybe 25, 30 feet across, they were ordered to surround it as a standard military procedure. One wonders what those giving the orders or following those orders from whoever gave them initially knew about what they were sending these men in to confront. For me, it is an open question and a very disturbing one.
Well, it certainly is, and a little bit more about this ground fog. It glowed, I take it, and did it have a certain color or anything?
yellowish gray comes to mind. And again, about a foot off the ground. And it's one thing to encounter a ground fog. It's another thing to encounter a self-contained ground fog. That makes no natural sense. Also, they had brought what they call lightalls, which are gas-operated like big Klieg lights, the kind of big lights that some of us associate with the old Hollywood premieres. All of the gas tanks had been topped off at the before they left the base, and none of them worked when they got out to the field. There was no ambient light whatsoever. It was a moonless night. They were a mile, at least, maybe more, from the sister base of RAF Woodbridge and a good 5 or 6 miles from RAF Bentwaters. They were in a farmer's field. The only
and you're saying that they were out of gas, literally?
No, I'm saying that they had full tanks of gas in those light, in those gas engines that powered those lights, but that none of them worked when they got them out to the field and tried to start them up.
So they couldn't look inside the fog if they pierced it at all anyway.
Well, they were having trouble with their radios, flashlights. You know, the things were not normal. Things were not working well. Larry and other men have described a ferocious static electricity charge as they walked through the forest to get to the area. You know, not the kind of thing you encounter when you rub a child's balloon on your arm and the hair goes up. For me, the most dramatic way to communicate it is something Larry told me a long time ago, which was to remind me that these troops wore berets. They did not wear helmets. And that these were overall young guys, most of them, you know, still in their teens, who had good, thick, healthy heads of hair. And the electricity in the air, the static electricity, was so virulent, it was starting to push their berets off their heads. Now, that's static electricity.
It certainly is. You're going to take a break. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a minute, Peter, and continue this discussion. I got some other things I want to talk to you as well before we get off of here. We got another hour to go.
Yep.
Not quite an hour because we're going to play a little bit of Carl Hart's tape. Mm-hmm. But what you've been talking about, Peter, I've talked to you about this many times. We've done shows about it. And
yes,
it's still riveting. It's still it's the kind of thing you sit on the edge of your chair for.
It still obsesses me, Jerry. And being back there last month, it was as riveting as it always is.
Yeah, and you saw the nuclear storage area.
Yes.
Yourself.
Yes.
So that gets some validity to it as well. I'm Jerry Pippin. Peter Robbins is our guest. We'll be right back.
You're listening to IRN, the Inception Radio Network, Chicago, Illinois.
Hello, Inception Radio Network listeners. This is Amanda. Remember, you can take your Inception Radio shows on the go. Just download the Inception Radio Network app for your iPhone, iPad, or Android smartphones and access live shows, past shows, guest lineups, and much more. Just visit the iTunes Store or the Google Play Marketplace and download it today for free. Looking for a cure for boredom? Never worry. IRN's interactive website introduces a number of ways to pass time while you listen to your favorite show. Choose anything from the IRN Chat Lounge, Game Lounge, Video Lounge, or the Mood Lounge. These fun, exciting features let you chat in real time with fellow listeners, view live skywatches, play daily posted online games, or pick a show based on topic. The choices are endless, so use your time wisely by keeping it all on IRN.